Welcome to The Local Point. My name is Andrew Day and I'm the leader of Warwick District Council. This is an informal, behind-the-scenes conversation with people who are shaping the policies and programs, touching lives right across Warwick District and thrashing through some of the real issues we're working on at the moment across the district. Well, we're flying solo here today. It's just me and the Vice Chancellor of the University of Warwick, Professor Stuart Croft. Welcome, Stuart. You've made Thank it you. to 1 Mill Street for the Local Point. It's an honour to have you with us.
I've been to 1 Mill Street several times. It's wonderfully buzzy as well today, which is a great thing.
Well, I believe there's a challenge on outside as to drinking a Guinness pint to an exact measure or something. I don't know what the members get up to here.
No, and I can't quite see too much Guinness being drunk, actually, but I'm sure someone somewhere is drinking Guinness.
It's good of you to come in. I know it's a very busy time and there's so much going on with the university. And I just think one of the opportunities I've had in bringing this particular podcast to life is to enable others to share some of the conversations I've been having. And yes. Many of them have been with you and the shared vision that we really have for Warwick District and for the university. But can I just start a little bit about geography so we understand the University of Warwick is not in Warwick, obviously, and we do fish the odd student out of Warwick Station and send them on to Coventry. But you deal with a number of different local authorities. Do you want to just talk through the geography and where your assets are?
So in terms of the geography, so the main campus sits right on the boundary between the City of Coventry and the County of Warwickshire and the District of Warwick.
Yep.
Most of our buildings are on the Coventry side because historically it was the case that it was more straightforward to get planning permission on that side.
Okay.
So it started on that side and grew on that side significantly. But you know, we have now grown along the road that is the boundary between city and the district on the other side as well. So we sit in those two places. So we deal with City of Coventry, we deal with County on transport and so on, and with York Good Sales on planning and economic development and a whole variety of other issues as well. We also have a site at Wellesbourne, which is now our Stratford Innovation District.
Yes.
And that is a place where we already have a number of companies working there. Mm-hmm. It is also the old Horticultural Research Institute, and so there are some extraordinarily scientifically valuable fields there that everybody knows exactly what's gone on those fields for like 60 years. So in terms of crop science, it's genuinely internationally leading. And we also have a site in the Shard in London where we do a lot of training and teaching for business schools. And we have a bespoke contract with the Bank of England. So all the Bank of England's graduates come in and do their postgraduate work with the Warwick Business School in the Shard. And we've now got a new program, which is the Warwick Business School and the Bank of England together training central bankers around the world, which is an incredibly exciting program. So we're in Coventry, Warwick District, Stratfordish, Londonish world.
Yeah, but you are a global player. I mean, scale term wise, how many students are we talking about for the University of Warwick?
We're now about 29,000, and that will include a whole variety of categories. So we've got about 1,000 degree apprenticeship students. So they're not, of course, here all the time. Mm-hmm. They come, they go back to their workplace, and they come again for education. And we have nearly 1,000 now online. Well, in fact, over 1,000 online students. Doing online education in lots of different ways.
Yeah, so this is it's a growing phenomenon, obviously. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But in scale terms, so just for residents to understand that, I mean, Warwick District is about 140,000 people. Leamington is about 50,000 people. So if you say, give or take, you know, 29,000, 30,000 thereabouts for the university, in scale terms, that's sort of, you know, 60% of the population of Leamington. It's quite a big show. And of course, as you say, many online. But they're not all local students, obviously, as you were saying. Mm. So of your total numbers, where are you drawing from? How many are international students or British residents?
So about 70% roughly of our students are British.
Okay.
Very strong British numbers at undergraduate level. Mm-hmm. Much stronger international numbers at postgraduate level. For a postgraduate level, we run a series of one-year master's programs. Mm. And they are incredibly attractive to students right around the world. And they're in particular areas which are directly useful to these people's careers. Yeah. So in business, in economics, in mathematics, or Warwick Manufacturing Group. Some particular programs in medicine as well. So one of our big online successes is in training students in diabetes care. So it's directly applicable, and a lot of those students come from Middle East, South Asia, East Asia. So serving particular needs, as it were, particular market needs. But the vast majority of the undergraduates are, as I say, are UK. And actually, the vast majority of those are from England, and the vast majority are from really the Midlands South.
Okay.
So we don't really recruit huge numbers from the north of England. Some, obviously.
Yep.
But we're very much a Midlands, London, South East recruitment area.
Yeah. That's interesting, though. I mean, I have to say, one of our friends from Manchester sent their son to you, and he's been studying German and law. And I believe he's now presently with a partner university. I can't remember where exactly in Germany, but I thought the whole reach, the element of it, that combination, and that combination of study that you can do now compared to when I was a long time ago going through university.
We have the best part of 1,000 students a year abroad.
Yeah.
For the whole year or part of the year, or even for just a short period of it, getting various sort of international experiences. And it might be a core part of their program in the way that you just described, or it might be work experience, or it might be volunteering. We have a lot of students who go and do volunteering work internationally as well. So that's a big number, 29,000, but you take out of it the online students, take out of it, you know, the degree apprenticeships who come and go, take out of it those students who actually aren't resident at the moment because they're doing something else around the world. And it's quite a fluid population as well. But it is the size of a small town.
It is. It's a serious community. And I know our half of the main campus, by the way, residents, if you're trying to work it out, it's the main road through the university, the fun side, as I call it, which is where it's to the left as you come into the university. Warwick Arts Centre, sadly, is in Coventry. It's fun, though. I don't mind visiting there a lot, actually. You've done some fantastic work. But the campus has evolved and actually it's got to meet changing needs. I know we've got a planning application coming forward now, finally registered for the new business school. But you have some news today, as I understand it, on the business school that's got some phenomenal accolades and rankings. You want to share a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, actually, our business school does extraordinarily well in a whole series of global rankings. And of all of them, the ones where they are so spectacularly successful is in that whole distance online learning space. Warwick Business School started distance learning programs back in the middle 80s. And then really it was only them and the Open University who were doing this kind of thing. And of course, the Open University had the great advantage of having set pieces of television time to broadcast.
Yes.
And Warwick Business School didn't. So they had to be much more imaginative about how the materials would be shared. It's become much easier now, of course, with computers and online learning, but absolutely top rankings around the world in those online programs. I mean, literally world leading.
So we're talking what, second best, as I understand it,
in the world.
In the world.
Yeah. It's a bit disappointing. I'd like to be first. Obviously.
I'm sure you're going to go there, but it's something I know you're going to drive the team on. But that is quite extraordinary. And as you remind us, that's not just happened overnight. That's something that started in the mid 80s, and you've been honing
and refining, developing.
And of course, there's a number of overseas students that attend online as well. And you did refer earlier to the relationship with the Bank of England. It does slightly concern me that so many central bankers might be being trained. I'm sure that's a good thing.
I think it's better to have them trained than have them untrained.
Correct. I'm sure there's some merit in that. But in space terms as well, you referred earlier about Wellesbourne and what you've been obviously inherited and been building there. But it's the potential for research and development and some of the exciting areas that you're going in to take advantage of our automotive footprint and our geography. I mean, we are literally in the centre of England.
That's right.
What's coming forward? What are you seeing in you know, scoping out in the next 5-10 or so years across both, obviously, Wellesbourne, but also on your main campus?
So on the main campus, the two big new areas of development are one, as you said, a new school for business and also for economics.
Yes.
Not going to merge them, keep them separate.
Good point.
Which will give us some real opportunity to have just higher quality space for staff and for students, of course, as well, and give us an opportunity for just a few more specialised courses. Specialised courses, such as for the central bankers, work incredibly well, particularly in the international marketplace. And more on the kind of heart of the campus itself, we're doing this big development in STEM. So that's about a £400 million investment that we'll be making in physics, in chemistry, in engineering. Some of that also hopefully will be of benefit to WMG. WMG's grown enormously, as you well know, over the last few years, and has now a number of different areas of specialisation. But WMG, like the business school, are now delivering a lot of fantastic education online and also abroad. Yep. So rather than bringing everybody in,
yes,
we're able to go and deliver quite a lot of education with partners,
yes,
in different different countries around the world. So these will be big, big pieces of development. We're also doing a lot of work on medicine and life sciences. Medical school is only just over 20 years old, which honestly, for a medical school, is nothing.
And it's quite. If you might, one of the USPs for the medical school is that you can be a graduate in another field and come to medicine later. Am I right? And then Warwick in particular specialises in conversions, if you like.
Exactly
bringing people to
and them. And the great thing about that is, as you say, you've got people who've already got a first degree, and it could be in anything. They do an aptitude test,
sure,
and other tests. Sure. So we have to know that they can actually be a doctor and have the right mindset for it. But then we'll do all the training, do all the education.
Yeah.
And whereas, as it were, a normal undergraduate degree is 5 years, the graduate entry is 4. So it's very, very accelerated as well. It's quite good for the exchequer.
Yeah,
it saves them a little bit of money. But for students, it means that they get an awful lot of time with patients, with professionals, with doctors.
And actually, if you think about it, they're mature age students. They've gone through the Freshers' Week. They've done, I mean, if you don't mind me saying, they've settled, and one would hope, and they've clearly made a decision to make.
They've
that
clearly
commitment.
Made that decision. And that's the really big
and
thing.
And then they've
that's
got to the get really the grade that pass those aptitudes tests, and then
exactly so.
And then they're off with a bullet to get it exactly all done so. In 4 years. So we're looking for new doctors. Many of them might come that route. I mean, as far as you know, our need to find more doctors for the NHS.
Whereas there's a deregulation of numbers for universities and students across the piece, it is not the case in medicine for doctors.
Right.
There are fixed numbers, and that's part of the debate at the moment, isn't it?
Yes,
because
it
obviously,
is.
As we can see, it's quite hard. At a certain point in someone's life to retain a doctor, they tend to retire quite early. So we need, as a country, to have very, very clear workforce planning in this space. And probably need to train quite a lot more doctors.
Can I go off piece slightly here?
Because I don't know.
It's going to be dangerous. It always is. In Australia, there's a certain... If you take on... train someone in a highly expensive field like medicine, or, dare I say, veterinary science is another one that's quite... Six years,
absolutely.
And you know,
absolutely.
You know, doctors look after one particular species that they have to cover
that's
off
right.
and all. You're trained. The state will pay for this, but you're then bonded to work, if you like, in providing that service. So if you're trained as a doctor, you might be sent out to Western Queensland to be the sole doctor. But it can be quite exciting, by the way, in those bush towns.
If you say so.
If you survive it. But that's part of the obligation. Even teachers, dare I say, would go through and be trained as teachers, but then go out to the country towns to be primary school teachers and so on. And that was their way of making sure that it all worked. I'm just testing your views here, because being a father of students with quite sizable student loans, that capacity to actually pay down or clear your student loan, you know, that to actually by taking up posts that we need filling, whether it's in the NHS or elsewhere, what is there any debate or discussion around that? Where the whole student fee, I'm really going off on a piece here, but is the public benefit, if you like, being really properly weighed here? Because it's not cheap. To train a doctor, six-figure sums, I'm going to guess.
Yes, that's right. Oh,
easily?
Yes, absolutely. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Overall, all the years. Yes, that's right. That's right. Including, of course, all the placements that they have
Indeed.
In the hospitals as well.
And
the funding will go to the hospital to support that. So we, of course, as you well know, have a completely different national ethos in this. I mean, it is about the individual. The individual student owns their debt. I mean, I always say to people that if I could borrow money on the same terms that salary had to point past a certain point before you have to pay anything back and so on and so forth, I think a lot of people might take that debt. But it is a serious issue, you know, the level of student debt. And you will hear, I hear, others will hear numbers of parents saying, well, I don't really want my daughter's son to go to university because of the debt that sits behind it. But I would really encourage everyone to look at the upside.
Yeah.
So what is the salary upside of graduate jobs? So for us, after 15 months of being a graduate, so after the summer, getting the first job, getting their feet under the table, two-thirds of our students earn more than £27,000.
Wow.
So you can pay it back quite quickly if you get the right kind of government job. Now, I'm always really nervous about this conversation because it makes the whole thing sound, you know, incredibly pecuniary.
Yeah.
And actually, we have students, as you'll expect, who'll go on and be musicians, they'll be artists, they'll be singers, they'll be authors, and that's great.
Mm.
So it's not all about measuring it in terms of the money, but two-thirds in that kind of space gives a real sense. So for us, our students' financial success mm-hmm. puts us in the top 10 in the country. It actually puts us seventh mm-hmm. in the country in terms mm-hmm. of that financial success. Mm-hmm. And that is an important counterpoint, I think, to the it's all very, very heavily indebted. But to come back to your question, bonded labour doesn't have a great reputation in this country.
No, I know. I know.
We haven't done great things with it, so I'm not sure it has a future.
No, I suppose it's a bit typically Australian, quite authoritarian. I mean, you have to go and pick fruit now if you go out there for. it's just I've seen and have friends again, children gone through, studied medicine, graduated as doctors, and then emigrated to New Zealand.
Yeah.
You know, and I kind of think we need doctors here, and we're going to make those scarce number of places and the commitment and resource that goes into the training.
But possibly part of the solution is about the jobs that they do here.
Yeah.
And the support they get here and the conditions they get here.
I like this. Okay. So making it more attractive
make
to stay
it more
here
attractive to stay
than to go to New Zealand. Yeah.
And you hear lots of people talk about just salary differentials.
Yeah.
That's one thing. Yeah. And we'll see what happens with negotiations over that at the moment. But the conditions are really important as well. There are, I think, quite significant evidence to say there is overwork in our NHS system.
I think that's indisputable. And I think you're absolutely right. Money isn't always the primary determinant. I'm sure for someone choosing a vocation like medicine, you're not doing it for the money, but you do expect to have the right sort of working environment.
That's right. I mean, money is never unimportant, is it?
No.
But people are drawn by the vocation, and the same, of course, in teaching.
Yeah.
People are drawn into the vocation of teaching. Well, absolutely, somebody who's a teacher will be listening to this at the moment and say, I want a fair pay. Of course. Not arguing that. But again, in education, a lot of our schools, we do need some more investment in facilities some of the organisation as well.
No, I wholeheartedly agree with that. And you make a good point, and particularly with a particular medical school that is aimed, people are choosing later in life to come to that. They're doing that not for money. They're doing it because of a particular vocational calling and a desire to pursue that. I get that. It's really interesting because I'm aware because of our various points of contact, whether it's about planning or how we work. We're both board members of the local enterprise partnership. The interlocking and if you like, the strengthening of the importance of the place of the university in our economy and in the world. People, I don't think, realise just what impact it has on new business starts. As an institution, your tentacles are wide and quite, important, if you like, to the future of this region.
So just a few examples on that. We had some work done by London Economics to understand what our economic impact is in our part of the West Midlands, and it's £1.15 billion a year.
Right.
We employ 8,000 people, but actually there's another 10,000 people whose jobs are dependent upon the business of the university.
So by comparator, the automotive industry across the whole West Midlands is 50,000 jobs dependent. What you're sharing with me there is the University of Warwick effectively is 18,000. That is that's extraordinary. Right. Right. I mean, there are other universities
there
in the region as well.
Coventry, of course, just up
of
the
course,
road.
Yeah.
So that's right. We've worked with more than 700 companies since 2020 that are in the startup or scale-up mode, and we've helped support them raise $100 million in financing since 2020. Mm-hmm. So as you were leading me towards that whole area of the economy, universities are big players.
Pivotal. And it's interesting that the stats show that Warwick District has a really high new business startup and entrepreneurial rate compared to Warwickshire. And we stand out by a long way. And I wonder why that is.
Yeah, I mean, I think
it's part of the just proximity geography.
There's massive opportunity for us in this part of the world, this beautiful part of the world, to really be at the forefront of supporting new industries, new companies, new technologies. And if we can get our facilities right between us, if we can get our conditions right, we could really drive innovation for the UK as a whole. In the way that it happens at the moment in Cambridge.
Yes.
Fantastically successful.
Yeah.
But you constantly see the story of Cambridge is they're kind of reaching capacity.
They are, yeah.
We have lots of capacity for really high quality jobs and really, really big improvements to the local economy and national economy.
In a way, it's not. I would never describe the University of Warwick as a Cinderella university. You're far from that. But it does feel that the sort of Oxbridge, you know, brand, if I could describe that internationally, then there's the surprise that is Warwick, if you see what I mean. And in brand terms, because that's my training background, obviously the business school is very prominent in that brand, and WMG more and more. The opportunities around biomedical science and so many other domains, just, and the innovative way in which you're delivering, if you like, the learning, as well as the research and development, you're in a good place actually in so many ways. It doesn't mean the ambition is there, I know, and there's plenty of challenges. But if I could stretch this on a bit, if you were thinking about the next 10, maybe 25 years. What would be your vision? Where would you say this is, if I will feel as Vice Chancellor, I've set us on a direction and done something to achieve that? Is there something in particular that would you put a marker on for the university?
Unfortunately, there are several things.
Okay,
I'm afraid you're going to get a little, just a little homily. Just a little homily. So, so the absolute heart of this is always quality. Always driving quality. It's not about the quantitative indicators, although of course they are impressive and they are important when you talk about people in good jobs. The quality is central, and one of the reasons that we've got this plan to invest so significantly in the state at the moment is that with the right quality facilities, you get better quality outputs.
You do.
So that's a big driver. So we are very ambitious for what we can do in mobility, whether it be from battery technology right through to some of the machines themselves. Some work on aircraft as well.
Yeah,
you know, we can't keep pumping out fossil fuels from planes around the world, so we need to have real progress on that. And there's been a recent report come out to say it's going to take a long, long time to get to that space. The world hasn't got that much time.
No.
We've got to accelerate our work in this space.
That's true.
But you said a couple of times biomedical. So biomedical is a big opportunity.
Because we're all living longer, and there's
and
so
for our
many.
Region.
Yeah.
And biomedical is exactly as you say. It certainly is the research that comes out of laboratories dealing with viruses and dealing with conditions. But it's also, as you were driving me towards, it is also about our behaviours. It is about ageing. And we have an agreement with Arden Cross that as that development takes shape, as the HS2 station gets built, it's just over the border in Solihull, it's in our collective wider geography, that we will be developing a medical innovation park. Then what I would love to be developed is the use of AI, big data, for personalisation. So that when you get in your car, you'll get some information. Your heart rate's a bit up. Are you okay?
Are you feeling a bit stressed today, Andrew? Yes.
Or Andrew, you've put on a little weight.
Now,
actually, I think the research is that nobody really wants to hear, Andrew, you put on a bit of weight. But there are ways of getting those messages across. Just to give people moments every day to reflect on well-being and on healthy lifestyles. And there's a huge industry behind that, of course.
Yeah.
Huge opportunity for companies to commercialise that work. And I think that could be a real focus of what we do.
But
isn't it,
it's bringing together various disciplines as
it is,
well.
Right.
I mean, when you're talking about the AI, then the biomedical, and even automotive, you say getting into your car. I mean, that whole interface, the opportunity of being in a space.
There's lots of economics in there. There's lots of psychology in there, behavioural science. You know, what will work as a cue for you, and what will turn you off if you hear that? It's a great opportunity for genuinely problem focused research that has real commercial application. And will improve lives.
Yes.
This is the sweet spot, isn't it?
And it's interesting. We had a presentation from the Director of Public Health for Warwickshire the other night at our last council meeting. And what was fascinating to me was the differential between, you know, how long people live in good health and then how long they actually live.
That's right.
I mean, forgive me, but I think you said something like it was 62 years for adult male of living in good health, and then we get to 81 years. So there's a big gap. If we could just lift that 62 closer to 81, let alone living longer,
that's
just actually living in good health longer is the prize.
And leading more productive lives as
of
well.
Of course.
We'd all feel better, wouldn't we, if we could lead longer productive lives. I don't necessarily mean, you know, working for the rest of your life, but you know, engaging with family and just doing things that make our society better.
But also, I will say this, but working is different. I mean, what I do as a counsellor isn't, in inverted commas, work. I'm doing it as my hobby, in inverted commas, but actually...
You are a strange person, aren't you?
I am an odd one. But as we live longer, you know, there is opportunities for us to still be active and engaged, not necessarily doing a paid day-to-day job.
I mean, compared to a lot of cultures, we're not great, are we, at learning from experience?
Mm. That's true.
We have people around in this district who are very experienced and know a lot about the world. And
absolutely.
You could perhaps draw a little more out of them for future generations.
And how you unlock that in a way that they don't feel as if, what's the word, they're being so driven back into a work-type context that they can engage in an appropriate way. That's right. But it's all the benefit of actually living longer, healthily, like living longer. And I could see the real... value add there for the university,
and as we know, some of the challenges that give people such a long, not good health lifestyle are medical. The research around dementia, for example, is critical in this space. But we also know that behavioural choices impact greatly upon the nature of dementia and when dementia bites and how it bites. So it really is bringing together the medical with a lot of the kind of behavioural side as well, and how we lead our lives, what we eat.
Indeed.
Drinking beers.
Just saying. It is Friday afternoon. And for those of you who may have a giggle, there is a bit of Irish music going on in One Mill Street, so that's what's coming through the podcast studio doors occasionally. Just turning back, I mean, Leamington's obviously very close to my heart and to yours, I know, and many of others who do live or come into the town. And we've just launched a new transformation board, and I know Andrew Todd, et cetera, has come along to that, and... It's a great forum, actually, as well, for us to really sort of get people engaged in some of the real choices about where the town goes, because there are exciting opportunities coming. But there's been an ongoing debate throughout my whole time as leader over these past 4 years about the student population in Leamington Spa, the trends and direction for that. And we've undertaken, with your support as well, some initiatives there in a genuine partnership, which I think has been very constructive. Do you want to talk, if you would, just about where you see student accommodation going? You know, you're talking about growing numbers. Does that mean we're about to get thousands of more students in Leamington? I mean, what's your perspective on that?
We have grown quite significantly as a university, both over the last 20 years, but also over the last 6 or 7 years. Mm. We have built more accommodation on our campus, but our growth... is greater in numbers than the additional spaces that we have on campus.
Okay.
And we have been able to grow in the way that we have because of the provision of the private sector. Mm. Not so much in Leamington.
Okay.
So although there are maybe some behavioural issues that you might mention in a moment, maybe there are that, year on year, the last 4 years, there have been reductions in the number of our students living in Leamington. Small, but slightly downwards. Around the campus, there are now a number of the purpose-built student accommodation, privately organised, privately run, for-profit, into which a lot of our students go.
Yep.
And they can live, they feel like they're on campus.
Yeah.
They can walk in, they can cycle in,
they can
see a film to the Arts Centre in the evening and be back
in
their rooms for 10 o'clock or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And we've also had a lot of agreements with some of the purpose-built accommodation in the city of Coventry. Now, traditionally, we had very few of our students living in Coventry, and 7 years ago, we decided we wanted to support people in going to Coventry as well, because it's part of our neighbourhood.
Sure.
And there are a lot of internationally run, purpose-built student accommodation in Coventry, and they tend to sell that accommodation directly to their nationals in country before they come.
Okay.
We can't control, of course, where students live, because they are citizens. They do have rights.
And they're adults.
There is a market. And they will react to the market. Our view is we would ideally not like to see additional numbers of our students come to live in Leamington. Mm. We would like to support more purpose-built accommodation rather than the HMOs that we know have had some problems, which you're probably about to share with me in a moment when I stop speaking.
You know all about them, but
and it is important. You know, I'm not in any sense trivialising that. That is important. We have, I'll give you the chance to say it, but we have, you know, some students whose behaviour is unacceptable.
Mm. And you've been very forthright about that, and you've committed resources to help us, in a way, be locus parentis, be local parents. And I think we forget sometimes that being a parent of two that went away to university, I'm sure possibly their behaviour, my children's behaviour, was not brilliant where they went. And occasionally we do have the odd student that is still an 18-year-old that drinks too much or behaves in a particular way. But by working together, we can provide that if you like, support. And I've been conscious that the university's invested resources and worked closely with the district. But we've also needed, there are other parties at play here, one of which is obviously the private landlords who provide, and none of these HIMOs are an inexpensive option. I mean, £1,000 a month would not be an uncommon rental for a student to pay in Leamington for a room, and only a room, quite probably. And so we're quite keen to get the landlords more involved as well, to make sure the bins go out on the right day and in the right place and are stored appropriately. But we've got to work together to do that.
So that's absolutely right. And there's work on sharing information.
Yeah.
There's work on joint practices.
Yep.
And there's actually disciplinary work that needs to follow as we learn this. And that does happen. I think there is a powerful image for quite a lot of students given to them by mum and dad, that when mum and dad were a student, they lived in a terraced house in the middle of wherever it was that they were a student. Okay. And they had the best time of their life.
Okay.
And that is communicated. And so some of that is quite hardwired into a lot of the British students. That is the student experience, and they're going to have that. And where's the best place to have that? Well, it's Leamington.
Mm.
But they can have great experiences in Leamington without, you know, making a mess of the bins, without making noise to your neighbour and all the rest of it. And in the ideal world, we would be able to control collectively, including the students, a lot of this behaviour if we were more in those purpose-built.
Mm.
If we put the purpose-built accommodation in the right places, we can control things. Student Union have started Rate My Landlord scheme.
Yeah, yep.
Hugely important. I know you've been involved in that
indeed,
as well.
Indeed.
Hugely important because there are some landlords, as you say, which, in my view, our students shouldn't be staying there. But that doesn't matter because it's a market.
It's a market, and exactly that. And it's not we don't regulate that. But bringing in things like additional licensing, as we're
absolutely
just piloting and exploring that presently,
absolutely,
which was something we've learned from Coventry, and you've shared information with us on how effective that is, just brings an onus, if you like, and a financial imperative on landlords to do the right thing, and disadvantages if they don't. And I think with the new local plan that we're working on, there's opportunities to reimagine Leamington and where there is appropriate place for purpose-built student accommodation to actually then enable the freeing up of our terraces to return them, hopefully, to be proper housing, in inverted commas, and see that as part of the regeneration of the town.
So I hugely welcome this. I think it's massively important work, because it allows us to have the conversation that we are having, but a couple of other really important conversations as well. One is actually the student pound is quite important in Leamington. So I was saying earlier, 10,000 jobs not directly employed by the university dependent upon the university's work. Well, some of them are here in Leamington.
Yeah.
No students in Leamington, a lot of people lose their jobs.
Indeed.
But that's not what we're talking about, are we? We're talking about better living together. And the other conversation, of course, to have is we want more of our students when they are graduates to make a success of their lives here.
Indeed.
Not in London.
Because the metrics there, I know the massive draw card of London, and we've had both the advantage and disadvantage of being an hour and 8 minutes on a Chiltern mainline train from London, which means, of course, you graduate from the University of Warwick, and I know the Bank of England is based in London, but there is, the draw from your, business schools and other schools directly was into going somewhere else, really. Whereas against other universities, where there's a much more stronger, if you like, rooting geographically, there's a high level of retention. And for us, I think that's something we can work on as a council. How do we make things more attractive? First homes, and we were talking about this
absolutely
the other night, just
absolutely
having homes that are set at a price
absolutely
that graduates can purchase
absolutely
and start and settle here.
Absolutely. There really is, I think, a national emerging crisis about younger people getting on the housing ladder.
Mm.
It's a national crisis.
Mm.
And we see now some of the numbers. I think it is now that the average age of someone buying their first property is 32 or 33. And it never was that, was it?
It never was that. No.
So this is a big problem. Anything that we together can do locally is massively important, but actually would be doubly effective precisely because that's the problem that most people are facing. I think the other thing about smart, brilliant graduates staying in the area is it depends on employers. So who are the employers? What are the employers that will allow that growth? And if the students themselves are employing themselves because they're starting their own businesses and they're doing it here, not in Shoreditch, this is a win-win for all of us.
Indeed. It brings a vitality to the local community and economy. I notice, for example, when the university holidays start, because all of a sudden it's like someone pulled a plug out, you know, everything goes quiet, which for some, it's lovely at one way, but actually it's not great for keeping a vibrant mixed community going. So retaining more students helps us provide a sort of, sustainable local economy and community. And I'm also mindful, just if you don't mind me saying, from the council's finances, something the government I've been lobbying about. I mean, we have, I think, nearly 6,000 students living in Leamington,
just short of 6,000.
Which is in a town of 50,000, I'm using round numbers, is a significant proportion. Just over 10% of our community are students, and they change over. So we have to re-educate, which is also interesting and fun at one level, but challenging for some as well when they find a new set of neighbours next door. But the other side is, of course, students don't pay any council tax, but their landlords don't pay any business rates either. So effectively, we've got over 10% of our population for whom we provide, I don't know, bins and parks and all sorts of things that we don't get any council receipt to run our much-loved council services. I'm not whinging, although it might sound like that, because the plus side, of course, there's money going into the local economy. Very often it's the nightclubs or what you might describe as student eateries, but that's fine. That creates work as well. If we're not retaining more students, though, I think we're missing the benefit of having 6,000 students living here to whom we should be able to convince and sell a proportion of them to remain here and make this their home. And I think that is a prize worth working towards.
So my favourite example is a couple of students a few years ago in business. One had, for family reasons, a language from South Sudan. Another had a particular Indian language. And their idea was they would produce online materials to help farmers more easily get their crops in those countries to market. Online tool. They were fantastically successful. They cleared their first 100,000 turnover in their second year as university. And by the time they graduated, the business was worth more than $1 million in turnover a year. It just took off extraordinarily. It's an online business. What did they do with that? They took it to London. Yeah. There's no reason they needed to take that to London.
No.
There's nothing extra there. Now, they said that one of the reasons they were taking it to London was venture capital. Mm. There's better access to venture capital in London than there is in the Midlands. And that's partially true, but one of the things that we're working really hard on is providing that support for startups, not just university spin-outs, startups in our region, to access venture capital. Mm. So, as I was saying earlier, 100 million we've helped leverage in the last 3 years for a number of companies. But we are, as a university, a number of other universities, working together to launch our own venture capital fund. So we won't control it. It'll sit as a company separate to us. Mm-hmm. But all those people who want to start up companies, either our students, our staff, or people can gateway through us, can then present their case to venture capitalists to get that startup money or that scale-up money.
Yeah.
And that's what we need easier.
Yeah.
Need to be easier. Yeah. And then encourage people to say, this is a great place to live.
Make your
business here. Employ a few people here.
And it's geographically, it is, I mean, Izzy Seckham describes it as a roundabout in the middle of England. I mean, literally you can get to Nottingham you can make it in and out of London. You don't have to be based there. You can still serve clients and do business there. But it's equally from our side. It sounds silly, but it's some basic infrastructure needs. So, for example, yesterday I was out at AC Lloyd opening a new thing called The Space, which are a series of sort of double-decker lockups, really. Sorry about that, AC Lloyd, but they're much more attractive than that. But they're really low rent, really flexible in and out, so you can flip and get in and out. So if you're starting a new business, you're not signing up for a lease forever.
Right.
You've got a roller door. All the servicing's in there. There's shared kitchen, shared bathrooms further along, so you're not paying for that. It gives you a chance for these businesses to start out and not take too great a risk on those.
But I think we need, and forgive me for putting this bluntly.
Go for it.
What I think we need is a decision that in our part of the Midlands, we are going to champion innovation.
Yes.
We are going to champion it. We're going to support it. We're going to do whatever we need to do with central government to get support here. We're going to talk to those people, listen very, very hard to those who are starting their businesses and indeed are leaving with their businesses to understand what is it that will help them think this is the place to be and to grow. How do we give ourselves an innovation identity that will be globally powerful?
And it's, in a sense, being the appetite for risk is part of that. And it's not just the risk of the entrepreneurs. It's the institutions being prepared to back, if you like, and take risk. It's what you've been doing in so many ways, in the way, starting in the 80s when the business school was investing so heavily in this weird, wonderful new online service model. Look how that's matured.
Yeah.
And we as a district, and particularly with our local plan, need to not just make this like any other place. We've got to be prepared to allocate resource and space to enable innovation to flourish. And that means taking risk from a planning point of view. It's interesting what you say, because the other part is the partnership piece. I think we're going to miss the LEP.
Absolutely.
Do you agree?
Absolutely. I grieve, actually. Firstly, because the local enterprise partnership was a place to really focus what did we need in terms of economic development across Coventry and Warwickshire. Without that, how do we do that?
Yeah.
Secondly, because it was an opportunity to meet.
It was.
An opportunity to meet people across the whole of Coventry and Warwickshire who, across private sector and public sector, were doing interesting things or thinking about doing interesting things.
Yeah.
Or telling us what interesting things were being done in other parts of the country as well. And we won't have that convening power of the LEP as well. So I do regret it.
Shoot me down here, but I actually don't think the proposals for Coventry Airport for the Gigafactory would have happened without the LEP.
Yeah,
I think it enabled the planners to meet with the entrepreneurs and JLR and others and understand the opportunity that that place has and to overcome quite considerable barriers. I know it's not yet there, and hopefully it will be before too much longer, but without that LEP, we couldn't have thought about that.
I mean, the other thing is, as you put it as directly as this, a single voice. The Coventry and Warwickshire has many voices.
It does.
In local government,
it
many,
sure does.
Many voices.
So how many do you deal with? You've got Stratford, Warwick, Warwickshire, Coventry.
And Solihull
and
now.
Solihull.
And of course, because we are in Coventry, also the combined authority for various things as well.
Yeah.
And we had our LEP, and then we also had the Birmingham and Solihull LEP. So plenty. And sometimes there does need to be a single voice for Coventry and Warwickshire on a national scale if we're going to really get something. And I think the LEP did, in terms of economic development, the LEP did that.
And we'll learn more about where the West Midlands Combined Authority is going with their devolution deal, the trailblazer, as it's called. And I, obviously, this particular podcast comes out in a week or two after now, and we'll be learning things.
Thank you for reminding me.
I just thought I'd mention that, because we'll be learning things in the near term. But it's going to be... It's going to be really interesting to see where Warwick District sits with the combined authority, and there's quite mixed views at one level, resisting, if you like, getting more engaged in it. I personally am passionate that we should be at the table and we should be more engaged. And I know that's led to quite heated debate at times about whether and what format that should happen at a local government point of view. What's your view of the combined authority?
Well, I think we've given ourselves across the West Midlands the classic problem of a political structure which does not represent the economic reality.
Yeah.
So our real economic geography and our political representation do not mix together. And if government thinks that the Mets and boroughs that are in the combined authority represent the economic future of the West Midlands, they are incorrect.
Yes.
A huge, huge part of the economic, and I'd go further than that, I think actually the way of living future as well could be devised here of benefit, of course, across the West Midlands, but actually nationally as well.
That's exciting.
But we need the right space, we need the right framework for this to work. And we need it also because all of those entrepreneurs do not want to spend time dealing with lots and lots and lots of local authority bodies.
They want
to, in terms of economic strategy, they want to have one way of engaging. That's not to say that, you know, you abolish parish councils. I'm not saying that.
They do a different job, though.
They do a different job.
They're not,
But for economic development, we need to have greater scale and impact.
And probably for more than a generation, where there was huge dislocation, I believe, between Coventry and Warwickshire, and as a result, quite a lot of stagnation in certain domains, the LEP actually started to put us back together again. The Coventry and Warwickshire LEP, that, you know, as Nick Abel said, you know, there's not a fag packet between the words Coventry and Warwickshire, and I think there's something as we started talking about the loss of the LEP, and I'm struggling, I'm wanting to see the combined authority give us a platform, but it maybe it'll be too big. I mean, I will say this, and I'd welcome your comment on it, but I still firmly believe there is a place called South Warwickshire, which is quite different to North Warwickshire, and different in a positive way, one to the other, not one better than the other, they're just different places. And each has a different role to play in a regional context. And I personally believe our local government needs to be configured to address place rather than old historic lines on a map.
I mean, the metrics are simple, right? Mm. South Warwickshire is economically different, actually demographically different also to North Warwickshire. It is, I think, an indisputable fact that they are distinctive in those ways. But I mean, I think your point of geography is a really important one also when we think about Solihull.
Yes.
So Solihull, of course, used to be part of Warwickshire, as you tell me on many occasions.
Yeah, West Warwickshire.
And yet, because of the way in which you've got local government organised, there's a sort of psychological hard border.
Yeah.
That's very bizarre.
It is.
It is very bizarre.
Particularly when you look at things like, where's our international airport, you know, when we think about HS2 and the interchange.
It makes no sense to businesses.
None at all. None at all. So are you hopeful? Do you think we might be able to break through with the combined authority? Or is, again, I support things like unitary. I know that might sound odd as a district council leader, but I don't think our residents, and if you take their perspective, it makes any sense to explain to them that the district council looks after your off-street parking and your on-street parking is done by the county. You know, it just seems bizarre that, you know, the highways authority is separate from the planning authority. I don't know. Is your sense of where, what would be your advice to me, Stuart? Where should we be going?
I'm not going to do that.
Okay.
that's too much. I'm not going to do that.
Okay.
I mean, having planning and transport in separate places, as you well know, is the bane of many industries and lives, many companies, many. So understanding this is going to go out after we're speaking.
Yes.
So what I'm about to say now may be proved horrendously wrong, in which case, can we please snip it out?
Okay.
But it seems to me that the most important thing actually about this devolution deal that's just been done is actually not now, but what it produces for the future.
Mm.
So if I understand this correctly, and this is where it might need to be cut out if I understand it incorrectly.
Understood.
The commitment is that for the next comprehensive spending review, the West Midlands Combined Authority region will be treated as a whole in the same way as a government department.
Right.
So the West Midlands Combined Authority area as a whole
will
get funding for housing and transport and innovation and education.
A bit like Scotland does?
A bit like Scotland does.
Wow.
That's the promise in there.
Wow.
If I understand this correctly. And that is an enormous prize. That's an enormous prize because it says, actually, if we on that wider West Midlands basis can get our act together, we can actually drive our own strategic direction in the future.
Absolutely.
And the one tiny piece of advice, if I may,
would
share,
please,
is I think actually the quality of people in Coventry and Warwickshire in terms of their professions is exceptionally high.
Mm.
And adding those people into the West Midlands Combined Authority as is currently configured will only be good for the West Midlands Combined Authority.
Okay. That's
there's something about New Zealanders in Australia, isn't there? But I won't tell that story.
No, that was the New Zealand Prime Minister, Piggy Muldoon, who was quite a character. I think that was his quote, wasn't it? Yeah, he said that when challenged about the number of Kiwis emigrating to Australia, he said it improved the mean average or the average intelligence of both countries
at the same time. Yes,
like that. You have to think about that for a minute, but then you realise it's a good slap to the Australians. That's typical Piggy Muldoon. He was quite a character. But no, the point though is, if you look at the GVA, I mean, South Warwickshire is the second highest GVA in the West Midlands.
That's right.
And if the nature and mix, it's almost the mix of businesses that are quite make us more resilient and also able to take on opportunities as they're being presented. It is, though, reflected by the university again. Mm. I keep going back to that because of the diversity. You know, you're not a one-trick pony as far as universities go. It's that diversity that gives you the capacity to deal with change in the future.
And as we were saying earlier, as you were kindly inviting me to say earlier, it is a big machine now. It's a big part of the business. I mean, turnover this year about 800 million.
Yeah.
Right? So we will, in three or four years, hit the billion mark, a billion a year of income.
Wow.
So this is big stuff, right?
It
gives us, if we have a strategic framework in which we can all work together, it gives us a real opportunity across Coventry and Warwickshire to help support jobs and new businesses,
indeed,
as well as skills and education, which of course, we touched on at the start, but the skills and education, it's got to be a huge part of our economic future.
But our capacity then to deal with things like climate change, our capacity to play on a global stage, given your global, you know, reach, and generate real wealth through innovation, has got to come through a much stronger, more coherent partnership.
I don't think I've ever had a conversation with you that's gone on this long without you mentioning climate change.
Yeah, okay. Been trying to behave myself.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, but actually, probably the solution, there has to be a solution. Mm. Probably the solution to climate change is going to be produced by innovation.
Yes.
It's new technologies, it's new materials, it's also new ways of working, new ways of being.
Indeed.
But the new offers us the way out of the damage that the old has done. And again, why should we not be, as a part of this country, at the forefront of that?
And it is an agenda item for the whole world, not just for one country or one region.
Correct.
And part of us, again, very much the local government point of view with this local plan, put firmly on the agenda, how are we going to deal with the mitigation? How are we going to be able to adapt? Because the climate won't suddenly stop changing. We're going to have to live with a changed climate, and some of the projections for 2050 are, frankly, eye-wateringly scary.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. It's not called crisis for nothing.
No, it's not.
It's a crisis because it's genuinely a crisis and is a global crisis. But, of course, we can only do what we can do where we are.
Yeah.
And we must do what we can do where we are.
Yeah.
And again, that's about information. It's about sharing opportunities. It's about some education as well.
Mm.
Because a lot of things that we can do in our own lives feel small and trivial and unimportant.
Mm.
But if lots of people do them,
they add up.
It adds up.
But the multiplier effect here is the capacity through, for example, the university's international global reach. Is if we prove make changes in the way we demonstrate it works, it might be, and we can make money doing it, and we're, you know, everything wins. That can be cascaded out. It's got a global impact because of the significance of our institutions, like the University of Warwick.
That's absolutely right. But also, we as an institution, we've got to become greener ourselves.
Yeah.
We've got to do that. So,
but you've not messed about there. I mean, you had me out planting trees, which I loved, but you probably got some flack, did you, for that?
Yes.
But yes.
It became a meme.
It became a meme, did it?
Yes.
Oh, brilliant.
Yes.
I've never heard that before. That's brilliant.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So I mean,
you weren't part of the meme.
No, okay. Okay, that's a relief. But just briefly, I know we're sort of in the final furlough, so to speak. It is Cheltenham at the moment.
Yes,
so,
yes.
But what have your development plans and what you've undertaken have been ambitious on campus, let alone what you're doing in the classroom?
So we are committed to be net zero scope 1 and 2 by 2030. And it is phenomenally difficult because we've got a stack of 1960s and 70s grossly energy inefficient buildings.
Yeah.
Grossly energy inefficient buildings. But we think there's a way forward to do it, and also a genuine way forward to do it. So we would be generating all of our own green electricity ourselves on our land,
site.
Not just buying it in that other kind of way. So you might be getting a few applications in the not too distant for a bit more PV.
Obviously,
all of our new buildings are as energy efficient as we can. We're working at the moment on passive house for the standard for our new buildings. Mm-hmm. It adds phenomenal cost.
It does. We know.
So it's really, really, really difficult, but really, really, really important.
Mm.
And driving forward to that scope 1 and 2, which is difficult. Scope 3, there are things we're doing on that as well in terms of incentives for global travel. But that's a space where we do need global solutions, really, really make direction. So what can we do? We can do as much as we can on scope 1 and 2.
And actually, as you say, innovate and share possible technical solutions to scope 3.
Well, that's right.
You were talking about airline travel and the way globally we've got to respond differently there. But I've been very impressed as well, just in meeting you and visiting the campus. Your vision for the campus is a very sustainable green vision. The movement around campus, the way you've designed and put the trees and the avenues in, it's so attractive. I mean, it really is. I mean, and I know it costs more money, but actually there is a saving as well. The buildings are less expensive to heat and run.
Correct.
The
honest and brutal truth is that the financial structure is still not supporting organisations doing what they really ought to do for the world in terms of new build.
Mm.
It really isn't.
No.
So, yes, there are savings.
Yeah.
But the additional costs compared to those savings, it's out of kilter.
Indeed.
It's out of kilter. But it's still got to be done. We've got probably now 140, 150 acres of what is currently farmland,
mm-hmm.
which runs down to the HS2 line.
Mm-hmm.
And our vision is we'd love that to be a park. Yep. A park for citizens. Why not? We have a small constraint that there is supposed to be on the plans a road going through that. Our original idea was that road should be the first one in the country that only electric vehicles can go on.
Mm-hmm.
If you have fossil fuel, you can't go on it, but we don't have a route yet.
Yeah.
And absent a route, it's quite hard to start building the park because you don't want to put in a set of trees that get dug up 2 years, 3 years later. Yeah. I mean, this would be an absolute disaster. But the vision for there is that area will become a publicly accessible parkland. We'd like to do some exciting things with it.
Mm.
So we'd like to have some kind of visitor centre, which is about education, which is all about us sharing, everybody, citizens, sharing what they do with other citizens. Let's learn together what we do to lead a greener life. We'd like to see whether we can utilise some of those spaces to generate electricity. We'd like to see if we can create some new knowledge in that space.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to rewild. And the Crackley Gap will never be what it was.
No.
But we can rewild and do some good things in that space. And that would be a really exciting project.
And I do think as we're looking more closely and understanding more deeply the climate emergency, the impact on our biodiversity is significant. And I mean local biodiversity. It's something that's in Scotland.
Right.
I mean, literally on our back doorstep. Agriculture has not been fantastic
for supporting
and encouraging biodiversity.
That's absolutely right.
So as you say, the conversion of this land to something more sustainable that helps build out and strengthen our biodiversity has got to be good. And then learning and understanding that process is for elsewhere. But it's also about, as an institution, taking a lead and for others to see that as being important and the impact that then has. It's very significant.
What we can do as individuals, what we can do as organisations,
what's
in our control, that's what's so incredibly important. And then just very quickly,
sure.
In terms of the technological developments, as you know, because we spent a long time talking about Very Light Rail.
Yeah, indeed.
So the Very Light Rail project, owned and driven by Vision in Coventry City Council.
Mm.
We now have this amazing technology, which means that you don't have to dig up roads to put on.
So this is a battery, just for those who are unfamiliar, the Very Light Rail project is, again, it was sponsored and funded partly through the LEP.
That's exactly right.
But it's a Coventry push, and it's essentially a rail scheme that you can put on normal roads, is that right?
Exactly that. And you put, effectively, a thin layer of concrete on top of the road that is precast, just needs to be cut on-site, according to the bends and so on, upon which individual carriages can run. And the scheme would work so that you would call a carriage.
Wow.
It won't have a driver. It'll be autonomous. It'll be connected. And actually, if a lot of people call it, then two will come. Or three will come.
Okay.
And so it gets away from the big problem of lots of tram systems, which is you have to wait too long between them.
Exactly. And it's battery electric?
And it is.
Super.
It is. So it is green.
Yeah.
It is also, because of being connected and autonomous, incredibly safe.
Mm.
No human error.
Mm.
No human error at all.
Mm.
And we've been running some pods with this technology around campus over the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, when a squirrel runs in front of it, it stops.
The
squirrels are safe.
Squirrel-safe technology, I love it. But see, that's an innovation theme again.
That's innovation, absolutely.
And you bringing it first means that you take a huge amount. So someone can come along now and replicate. Once that scheme's up and running, you've done the learning.
Oh, right.
You can then replicate it in another place. Maybe we could turn trams back down the parade of Leamington Spa. There, I'll
Wouldn't
get
that
some
be
emails. And that might be Very Light Rail trams.
Wouldn't that be marvellous?
Yeah, there are.
Have a wider connection across Coventry and Warwickshire, and certainly connecting Ward District in.
Yeah, yeah. So, no, I understand. Well, super. I've got to say, Stuart, it's been fabulous to have you come in.
Thank you for the invitation.
We could go on.
We probably will.
Stuart Croft, Vice Chancellor of the University of Warwick, thank you so much for coming in and being part of today's Local Point.
Thank you,
Stuart.
Thank you.
It's been great having you join our conversations today. Please share any comments or pose questions for future episodes by email to localpoint@icloud.com. Thanks for joining us.